Numbers 35, and today we are coming to the close of our study in the book of Numbers. How many people, when I announced a few months back that we were going to be studying through the book of Numbers, let out a little bit of a sigh? Oh, you're kidding me. Numbers? How many people have just loved this study through the book of Numbers? Hasn't it been wonderful? It has been blessing me. It's been convicting me. But it has been a fabulous study as we begin to see some of the parallels with the Israelites and our own lives, of how we can be those that get stuck into these wilderness wanderings as we begin to walk in unbelief in areas of our lives, where we don't trust the Lord fully and believe that He's able to do something in it. Kind of leaves us in that place of wilderness journeying as the Israelites encountered here in the study of Numbers. It's been a great book. Well, we're going to be finishing it, wrapping it up today here. And in chapter 35, turn there with me if you're not already. And it says there in verse 1, "And the Lord spoke to Moses in the plains of Moab by the Jordan across from Jericho, saying, Command the children of Israel that they give the Levites cities to dwell in from the inheritance of their possession. And you shall also give the Levites common land around the cities. They shall have the cities to dwell in, and their common land shall be for their cattle, for their herds, and for all their animals. The common land of the cities which you will give the Levites shall extend from the wall of the city outward 1,000 cubits all around. And you shall measure outside the city on the east side 2,000 cubits, on the south side 2,000 cubits, and on the west side 2,000 cubits, and on the north side 2,000 cubits. The city shall be in the middle, and this shall belong to them as common land for the cities." And so God now is beginning to instruct the nation of Israel that as they are getting ready to move into the promised land. Now remember, this is what their whole journey from Exodus has been. Their journey was to take just a matter of days from Egypt to get up to the promised land there of Canaan. But again, as they're traveling along, remember, they decided to send some spies into the land to spy it out, 12 spies. 10 of them came back with that bad report. And it caused the nation of Israel to take a step backwards and begin to think, I don't think we can do it. Not going to happen. And so God had them spend the next 38 years in the wilderness, not able to enter in. Well, now that whole 38 years, 40 in all, since their exodus from Egypt, has passed, transpired. And so they are right on that brink there. They're on the east side of the Jordan River. They can see Jericho there in sight. And so they are getting ready to move into the promised land. And God is just establishing just those last details for when they get in there. And He says, now listen, the people of the tribe of the Levites, this is what you're going to do. You're going to give them cities within your inheritance. Why weren't the tribe of Levi to receive any of their own portion of land there in the promised land? Remember, what role did the Levites have? They served as priests. They were the ones that were to camp out around the tabernacle in the closest proximity to the tabernacle. Each of the rest of the tribes camped all around, but the Levites were the ones right around the tabernacle. They were to be the ones that were serving in the tabernacle, around the tabernacle, setting it up, taking it down as they journeyed from place to place. They had a special role that they were to fulfill that God had desired for them to play in the nation of Israel. They were to be the ones that were ministering on behalf of the people and before the people, before God in the tabernacle. And so they were not to have any of their own portion of land. Remember what God said to them back in Numbers chapter 18. Flip a few chapters back. Numbers chapter 18, and look at verse 20 with me. It says in Numbers 18 verse 20, "Then the Lord said to Aaron, you shall have no inheritance in their land, nor shall you have any portion among them. I am your portion and your inheritance among the children of Israel." God's saying, listen, you're not going to have any inheritance in the land like the other tribes are going to have, but here's the deal. I am going to be your inheritance. I'm going to be everything you need. I will provide for you. I will take care of you. As you are serving me in the tabernacle and serving the people, the nation of Israel, I'm going to take care of you. You are going to be blessed immeasurably more so than probably the others were because of your role that you're going to play. And so it is that as we begin to launch out perhaps in ministry or just in service to the Lord, we might find ourselves not really having much like what others might have. I'm not just talking about, you know, those in full-time ministry. I'm just talking about those that are desiring to live for the Lord and to serve Him. God might have you in a place where you don't have excess, where you don't have mass wealth. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but you might not have all the riches in the world, but God is saying, I am going to be your inheritance, your portion. I'm going to take care of you. I'm going to provide for you. And He often does that on a daily basis. A proverb says that He's not given me more than I need, lest I become kind of ungrateful. I'm totally paraphrasing this. Nor does He give me less than what I need so that I would have to go and steal and sin in the process of doing that. God gives us just what we need on a daily basis because He is our provider. He is our portion, our inheritance, as He would be for the Levites here, this priestly tribe that had a great blessing of serving God, representing God before the people and representing the people before God. And so in verse 6, now among the cities which you will give to the Levites, you shall appoint 6 cities of refuge to which a manslayer may flee, and to these you shall add 42 cities. So all the cities you will give to the Levites shall be 48. These you shall give with their common land. And the cities which you will give shall be from the possession of the children of Israel. From the larger tribe you shall give many, from the smaller you shall give few. Each shall give some of its cities to the Levites in proportion to the inheritance that each receives. And so we see now that God desired that the Levites be spread out through the land. Their cities would kind of encompass all throughout the land of Israel. It would not be just in one exclusive area. They were not to have their own portion and be all huddled together. This is a great reason why God says, you're not going to have your own portion. You are going to be spread out among the children of Israel. This would be important as, again, they were God's ministers. And He wanted them spread out so that they would be an influence throughout the other tribes there in Israel. Do you ever get thinking that it would be nice just to go and live in a Christian commune or something like that? To live in a city that was exclusively for Christians. Do you ever think that way sometimes? There's times where I think of that and go, man, that'd be nice. Where everybody just has a love for the Lord. Everybody just wants to serve the Lord. Everybody's just really being kind to each other. Hey, can I help you do that? Can I go and do this for you? Can I paint your house? That sort of, you know, it'd be great. People would be like just loving each other. And you think that way sometimes. You go, man, that would really be nice. We wouldn't have to struggle with people getting mad at me and me having to keep my flesh in check and, you know, kind of responding back to them in a bad way. It'd just everybody be nice and warm to each other. But you see, this, of course, isn't God's plan. He wants us as believers in Him to be in the world among the unsaved, that we might be that influence and witness to them. We are called to be the salt and light of the earth. That salt being that preserving agent where we are keeping the world from just sort of falling that much more into sin and corruption. Where we're being that influence in the world and in worldly things. And what a joy it is when we as Christians begin to look at our places of work, perhaps, as places of ministry. You see, we are all called to be a royal priesthood. We can all call ourselves part of that tribe of Levi, where we are that royal priesthood chosen of God to be that light in this world. And you have an opportunity many others won't have to be an influence in the lives that you are surrounded by from 9 to 5 or 8 to 4 or 7 to, you know, 11 at night, whatever your work shift might be. But we have an opportunity that others won't have to go and be that influence and to go and be those ministers in our places of work or whether it be at school, whether we're at home, wherever we are. We have a great opportunity to go and influence the world for Jesus Christ. And though we sometimes get caught up in that idea, how nice that would be, oh, if we could just all, you know, be a Christian community huddled together and, oh, it'd just be great and glorious. But that's not God's design. It's not God's plan. And God desired that the nation of or the tribe of Levi would spread out throughout the land. They would have 48 cities throughout the land. That was all around, from the south to the north, to the west, to the east, where they would begin to have that influence. And that's the role the priests were to play, as being God's representative to the nation and representing the nation before God. But unfortunately, even the priesthood became corrupt. Hosea chapter 4, verse 7 to 9 says, "The more they increased, the more they sinned against me. I will change their glory into shame. They eat up the sin of my people. They set their heart on their iniquity, and it shall be like people, like priests. So I will punish them for their ways and reward them for their deeds." You see, instead of influencing the nation, they themselves became influenced by their surroundings. That verse says, like people, like priests. The priests were becoming as corrupt as the people of the nation were. And instead of them having that preserving agent, that influence, they themselves were the ones becoming influenced. And the same can happen to us if we're not careful to walk in devotion and dedication to the Lord according to His word. We need to be careful that we're not going into the world and being like the world. God says we're of the world, but we're not to be like the world. We're not to do what they do. We're not to act as they act. We're to be, and a lot of Christians kind of look at that and go, well, we want to be able to really effectually minister to them. And so we've got to kind of be like them. We've got to adapt their principles. We've got to kind of act like them so that we can sort of, you know, begin to win them over for Jesus. And the world just begins to look at Christians like that and go, well, they're no different than me. Why do I need Christianity? Why do I need Jesus? If they're just acting like me, if they're talking like me, doing what I do, then I guess I'm okay. I don't see any difference. The world needs to see a difference in us. We need to be influencing the world rather than the world influencing us. And it breaks my heart to see churches that adapt worldly models or strategies or principles. Or it breaks my heart to see Christians that are just living in the world and like the world. It ought not to be so. So we need to walk in that devotion and dedication to the Lord, just as His word teaches us. We can't be those that isolate ourselves, nor can we be those that integrate ourselves into the world. Let's be setting that standard, that godly standard. And let's be shining our lights brightly for the Lord in this world, just as the Levites were to do, and begin to impact the surrounding tribes there in Israel for the things of God. And look at verse 7. I don't know if I already read these, but I'm going to read them again. "So all the cities you will give to the Levites shall be 48. These you shall give with their common land, and the cities which you will give shall be from the possession of the children of Israel. From the larger tribe you shall give many." So again, these tribes that were larger, that had a larger portion of land, there would be more cities for the Levites there within their portion of land. And the smaller portions of land would have less cities, of course. "You shall give many from the smaller, you shall give few. Each shall give some of its cities to the Levites in proportion to the inheritance that each receives. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, 'Speak to the children of Israel and say to them, when you cross the Jordan into the land of Canaan, then you shall appoint cities to be cities of refuge for you, that the manslayer who kills any person accidentally may flee there. They shall be cities of refuge for you from the avenger, that the manslayer may not die until he stands before the congregation in judgment. And of the cities which you give, you shall have 6 cities of refuge. You shall appoint 3 cities on this side of the Jordan, and 3 cities you shall appoint in the land of Canaan, which will be cities of refuge. These 6 cities shall be for refuge for the children of Israel, for the stranger and for the sojourner among them, that anyone who kills a person accidentally may flee there. But if he strikes him with an iron implement so that he dies, he is a murderer. The murderer shall surely be put to death. And if he strikes him with a stone in the hand by which one could die, and he does die, he is a murderer. The murderer shall surely be put to death. Or if he strikes him with a wooden hand weapon by which one could die, and he does die, he is a murderer. The murderer shall surely be put to death. The avenger of blood himself shall put the murderer to death when he meets him. He shall put him to death. If he pushes him out of hatred, or while lying in wait, hurls something at him so that he dies, or in enmity he strikes him with his hand so that he dies, the one who struck him shall surely be put to death. He is a murderer. The avenger of blood shall put the murderer to death when he meets him. Let's continue on here, and then we're going to back up and go through some of these principles here. Look at verse 22. However, if he pushes him suddenly without enmity, or throws anything at him without lying in wait, or uses a stone by which a man could die, throwing it at him without seeing him so that he dies, while he was not his enemy or seeking his harm, then the congregation shall judge between the manslayer and the avenger of blood according to these judgments. So the congregation shall deliver the manslayer from the hand of the avenger of blood, and the congregation shall return him to the city of refuge where he had fled, and he shall remain there until the death of the high priest who is anointed with the holy oil. But if the manslayer at any time goes outside the limits of the city of refuge where he fled, and the avenger of blood finds him outside the limits of his city of refuge, and the avenger of blood kills the manslayer, he shall not be guilty of blood, because he should have remained in his city of refuge until the death of the high priest. But after the death of the high priest, the manslayer may return to the land of his possession. And these things shall be a statute of judgment to you throughout your generations in all your dwellings. Whoever kills a person, the murderer shall be put to death on the testimony of witness. But one witness is not sufficient testimony against a person for the death penalty. Let's stop there. That's a lot of reading there. Your head is swimming, I'm sure. You're hearing about death, manslayer. You're going, oh my goodness, this is a bloody chapter. What is going on here? Let me try to summarize a little bit of it for you. First of all, God is showing now that of these 48 cities that were to be given to the Levites, six of those 48 cities were to be designated as cities of refuge. You see, back in Exodus chapter 21, there was the principle that if someone was killed, well then that person that was killed, the next of kin, the next person in that family, could go and seek avenge upon the murderer. And he would go and take his life. An eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, you know, there was to be that avenge. And it's not that God is condoning murder. That's the thing. Not that he is condoning that we go and seek, you know, capital punishment. But he is trying to put upon those boundaries, upon those things that the people were doing, people had in their heart. He's not condoning it by any means, but he's trying to put that boundary, that structure around it. And again, eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth was not to say, oh, we need to go now and kill that person, it's our right. But God's saying, an eye for an eye, tooth for tooth. Don't go beyond what that person has done to you. It was kind of an act of mercy or a stipulation of mercy there. Because I know when I was growing up, when somebody did something to me, you know, I mean, I was out for revenge. But I would always say, I'm not just going to get even. I want to get, you know, one up on this guy. I want to make him pay for what he's done to me. I want to make sure he doesn't come back my way again. I'm going to really lay it into him so that he just doesn't want to mess with me anymore. And that wasn't an eye for an eye, you know. I'd give him two eyes for an eye, that sort of a thing. And so, or I'd take two eyes for an eye, that sort of a thing. But God is trying to put that boundary of mercy around here. And so, the law in there was that if a person was killed, that next family member of the person that was murdered could go and seek revenge. But here God is saying, now listen, we're going to have, as we go into the promised land, cities of refuge. If a person accidentally killed another person, he would be able to go and run to the city of refuge. Once he was in that city of refuge, he was safe, he was okay, no problem there. Now, it's interesting. Let me back up a bit here, because look at verse 13. Of the cities which you give, you shall have six cities of refuge. You shall appoint three cities on this side of the Jordan, and three cities you shall appoint in the land of Canaan, which will be cities of refuge. It's interesting that the six cities of refuge were to be divided up, having three on the west side of the Jordan and three on the east side of the Jordan. Even though there were only 2.5 tribes on the east side, the rest of the tribes, the 10.5 tribes were, the 9.5 tribes were on the west side of the Jordan. Perhaps it would indicate that as these 2.5 tribes chose not to push on in all that God had for them, they would lead a life of greater sin and greater need for refuge. We talked about this, how the tribes of Reuben and Gad and the half tribe of Manasseh decided not to press on into the promised land. And we saw what happened when Jesus showed up there in the land of the Gadarenes. Demon-possessed man, having that herd of pigs and all. They were involved in some racketeering business, violation of the law. And there was that decline there, spiritually and morally. And so perhaps that this was a nation or these tribes that needed greater need for refuge. Now Joshua 20, verse 7 to 8, shows us the cities that were to be used. The cities of Kadesh, Shechem, Hebron, Bezer, Ramoth, and Golan. You can, if you're taking notes, Joshua 20, verse 7 to 8 shows us that. And Deuteronomy 19, verse 3 shows us that these cities were to have accessible roadways to them. In other words, it was to be easy to get to these places of refuge. I'm so thankful to God who does not complicate things or make it difficult to run to Him and find that place of refuge and safety. These were to be accessible places to go. Now, the Bible clearly uses these analogies and wordings to show the peace and the comfort that the believer finds in God through difficult ordeals. Psalm 46, verse 1 says, God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. More than 15 other times the Psalms speak of God as being our refuge. And in the New Testament, Hebrews chapter 6, verse 18 says that by two immutable things, in which it is impossible for God to lie, we might have strong consolation who have fled for refuge to lay hold of the hope set before us. Now, as we look at these cities of refuge, there is a wonderful picture and parallel of Jesus seen through these cities of refuge. First of all, both Jesus and the cities of refuge are within easy reach. They're within easy reach of the needy person. Six of these cities divided again and scattered throughout the land. So wherever you were there in the land of Israel, there would be an accessible city of refuge nearby. And so God again showing that I want you to be able to find that place of refuge in your time of need. It wouldn't be complicated. Now, the cities and Jesus himself are accessible to every single person. Romans 10, verse 8 to 11 says this. But what does it say? The word is near you and in your mouth and in your heart. That is the word of faith which we preach, that if you confess with your mouth the Lord Jesus and believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead, you will be saved. For with the heart one believes unto righteousness, and with the mouth confession is made unto salvation. For the scripture says, whoever believes on him will not be put to shame. See, it's right there. It's a matter of just speaking it forth, confessing the Lord Jesus, that God raised him from the dead. And he died for you. And he says, you'll be saved. You see, Jesus is that accessible Savior to us. We like to complicate it a lot, don't we? We like to think, well, you know, I'm not really that worthy right now, and I've got a lot of sins I need to deal with, and I've got to take care of this and that, and I'm a long ways from Jesus. No, you're not. It's a matter of speaking forth your need for him, saying, Jesus, forgive me, for I'm a sinner. He's accessible. He's available. He is there, just as these cities of refuge were to be there. And that would be a good thing, because as I said now, if somebody went and accidentally killed somebody, let's say I'm out, you know, hunting with Tony, let's say. We're out hunting and we're cruising around and we're, you know, we got our bow and arrow and we're hunting. And let's say, you know, I'm tracking a deer or something like that. I let back the bow, release the arrow, and my aim is way off. And all of a sudden, I just right into Tony, you know, and he falls down and dies. Be an accidental death. And I'd be like, oh my goodness. As soon as word gets back to his family, they're going to be after me. And as soon as that happened, you would just start hightailing it to that city of refuge. You'd be on the run. And you would have to go. You'd have to get there. And once I got to that city of refuge, I would be safe. I'd be fine. And that family member that was out for my blood would not be able to do anything. And it was the ability to go and seek counsel and to get a proper hearing among witnesses and to be able to show that, listen, first of all, I'm in the city of refuge. We can talk about this. It was an accident. Didn't mean for it to happen. Now, let's say I shoot him and he's lying there and he's still breathing. I'm thinking, oh my goodness, you know, and well, he's going to go, and once he comes, you know, comes to and gets better, well, you know, he's probably going to be angry at me. He's going to kind of, you know, start talking bad about me. Well, okay, I'm going to put him out of his misery, you know, so I take another arrow and I finish the job, that kind of a thing. Now, that would be premeditated. That would be murder. And so if I hightailed to that city, it wouldn't matter. I'd be sitting in that city, but now that avenger would still be able to come in and take my life because it was premeditated murder. It was meant to happen, just as we see here. If, you know, you take something and strike the person, you know, upon the head or whatnot, and you kill him, well, then you're not safe. But so those cities were close, that if something happened, if you accidentally killed somebody, that person would just start running so they would elude and get away from that family member that might be bearing down their path and trying to, you know, avenge the blood. You get to that city of refuge, it was accessible. You'd need to be there, and you'd find that place of safety there. So not only are the cities of refuge and Jesus within easy reach, secondly, both Jesus and the cities of refuge are the only solution for the one in need. You see, without that specific protection, a person that killed another would be destroyed. Many don't like the idea that Jesus is the only alternative and answer for life. They feel that if they're sincere in what they believe, it'll be okay. I may not really believe that Jesus is the only way, but, you know, I kind of have a belief in God, and I'm very sincere in what I believe, and I think that's going to be okay. People think that way. If a person had run to just any city after killing somebody, or accidentally killing somebody, and the revenger catches up and grabs a hold of him and says, "Now you're mine." You know, the person that was fleeing couldn't say, "But wait, I'm in a city. I'm sitting here in a city." The avenger would just say, "Yeah, but you're not in the right city." "But wait," the fleer says, I'm really sincere about this. I believe that I'll be okay. I'm in this city and everything will be okay." Doesn't matter how sincere that person is, he's not in the right place. And the avenger would take his life. You know, we have an avenger that's after us, an accuser, it says, of the devil in the Bible, who's looking to bring us down. And it's only by the person, the name of Jesus Christ, that you'll be saved. No matter how sincere you are in anything else, the devil's that roaring lion seeking whom he may devour. You can sit there and say, "But wait a second, I've got faith in Buddha or faith in Allah, that's going to be okay." No, it's not. Because it's only by Jesus that you're saved. And at the mention of Jesus, the demons tremble. He is the only way. He's the way, the truth, and the life. There's only one way to heaven, to that relationship with God, and it's found in Jesus Christ, the one that came and took our place upon the cross, that died for our sin. It's the only way, guys. It's only one solution. Thirdly, both Jesus and the cities of refuge are available for all. You see, it wasn't just for the Israelite. Notice what it says there in, I've got to find it now. Verse 15, thank you. "These six cities shall be for refuge for the children of Israel, for the stranger, and for the sojourner among them." You didn't need to be an Israelite to benefit from this city of refuge. Just as salvation is available for all. Not just the elect. Not just those that are trying their best to do good. This city of refuge and Jesus Christ, his salvation, is available for all. No one needs to fear that they'll be turned away from their place of refuge in their time of need. Romans 10, verse 12 to 13. "For there is no distinction between Jew and Greek, for the same Lord over all is rich to all who call upon him. For whoever calls upon the name of the Lord will be saved." John 3:16, probably the most quoted verse. "For God so loved the world." And it goes on to say that whoever believes in him will not perish, but have everlasting life. Whoever believes on him will not perish. It's available for all. Fourthly, so not only do we see that Jesus and the cities of refuge are within easy reach, they're the only solution, they're available for all. But fourthly, Jesus and the cities of refuge provide protection only within their boundaries. You're only going to be protected when you stay within the boundaries of that city. So if a person's been hanging out a few years in the city of refuge and decides he's going to venture out, if his avenger sees him, he could go and kill him. And the avenger would not be guilty because that person left the city of refuge. See, it's the responsibility of the one to remain inside the city. And we too are to be those that are abiding in Jesus. I'm not saying that people can lose their salvation, but it appears that people can leave their salvation, that they can walk away. They become entangled in the things of the world. 2 Timothy 4:10 speaks of a man by the name of Demas. Paul says, he's forsaken me, having loved this present world, and is departed for Thessalonica. Demas appears to be one that walked away. Now, whether or not he's going to be saved in the final judgment, we don't know. That's not up to us to decide. But Jesus said in John 15, verse 4 to 6, abide in me and I in you. As the branch cannot bear fruit of itself unless it abides in the vine, neither can you unless you abide in me. I'm the vine and you are the branches. He who abides in me and I in him bears much fruit. For without me, you can do nothing. If anyone does not abide in me, listen to this. If anyone does not abide in me, he is cast out as a branch and is withered. And they gather them and throw them into the fire and they are burned. Now, is this speaking of fire of judgment or the fires of hell? Well, we're not sure what's going to be the final outcome for those people. And I certainly don't intend to find out. Because I want to track with the Lord, abide in him, stick close with him, because he is my only source of refuge. And I don't want to go outside those boundaries. I don't want to test the waters. I want to stay as close to the Lord as possible, because it's in there that I am safe and I'm sound and I'm comforted, because he is my refuge. Lastly, number 5, with both Jesus and the cities of refuge, full freedom comes with the death of the high priest. Look at verse 28. Actually, you know what? Let's look at verse 25 first of all. So the congregation shall deliver the manslayer from the hand of the avenger of blood. The congregation shall return into the city of refuge where he had fled, and he shall remain there until the death of the high priest who is anointed with the holy oil. Verse 28. Because he should have remained in this city of refuge until the death of the high priest. But after the death of the high priest, the manslayer may return to the land of his possession. See, guys, we did not deserve to be cleared from sin. And we may wonder sometimes how that is so. It is answered simply in the fact that freedom from the penalty of sin, it's answered simply in the fact that Jesus, our high priest, died for us. And he died in our place. Jesus is that great high priest. He's the one interceding on our behalf, representing us before the Father, before the throne, praying on our behalf. He's our high priest. And he died for us. And it's his death that brought freedom from sin. Freedom from the penalty of sin. The penalty of sin was death. The wages of sin is death. And there are those that will say they believe in God, but they've not been freed because they've not believed in Jesus and the fact that he had died for them. People don't want to accept that. That takes humility to accept that someone had to die for me, that I couldn't do it myself. There are a lot of people walking around with a lot of pride that say, I don't want to turn to Jesus because I don't want to accept that I need him. I'm strong. I can make it myself. And there are those that don't want to receive his sacrifice simply because of pride. But unless you believe that Jesus died in your place to forgive you of your sin and rose again to prove he was the giver of life, you will not be free. But whoever turns to Jesus as our great high priest, the only way to right relationship with God, then you will be set free. Jesus says, therefore, the Son makes you free, you shall be free indeed. And notice it says in verse 28 that you'll be restored. After the death of the high priest, the manslayer may return to the land of his possession. And that's just what Jesus did when he died on the cross. You see, we were sinners. We were walking in the course of this world, dead in sin, as Ephesians chapter 2 will tell us. God intended, first of all, for him, again, just from the very beginning in the Garden of Eden, to be our possession, to be walking in that paradise, right relationship with God. But sin entered the world. And we were walking in accordance now to the course of this world. But Jesus came and died on a cross. Our great high priest took our place and allowed us to return to the land of our possession, where now we're not no longer ruled by the flesh, walking in accordance to the ways of this world, but we've been made alive, he says. Return to our rightful possession, where now the Spirit can fill our lives and take control, and we can live for him. We who were dead, he's made alive and returned us to that place of our possession. What a great work he has done for us. And it's also wonderfully pictured in these cities of refuge. Now, there's an important distinction to make between Jesus and the cities of refuge. The cities of refuge only help the innocent. The guilty would not find any refuge. But today, the guilty. I don't care what you've done. I don't care how great your sin is. Jesus is still that place of refuge, even for the guilty. No matter how heinous your crime or your sin might be, Jesus says, run to me, and I will forgive you. I will cleanse you, and you will find that place of refuge and safety in me. Cities of refuge couldn't do that. Well, verse 33. We're running out of time, so let's move quickly. Actually, we'll pick it up in verse 31. Moreover, you shall take no ransom for the life of a murderer who is guilty of death, but he shall surely be put to death. And you shall take no ransom for him who has fled to his city of refuge, that he may return to dwell in the land before the death of the priest. Money is not going to get someone off the hook. I wish that were true today. If a person has enough money, they can hire a good lawyer, and then oftentimes they can beat the judicial system. You know, get a good lawyer and they can spin things around and they can take the most hardened criminals and get them off the hook. But in this day, there would be no ransom to be paid for the life of the murderer. And then verse 33, you shall not pollute the land where you are, for blood defiles the land, and no atonement can be made for the land for the blood that is shed on it, except by the blood of him who shed it. Murder needed to be dealt with quickly, for unjudged murder pollutes and defiles the land, it says. Don't pollute the land where you are. Deal with each case quickly. Ecclesiastes 8, verse 11 says, because the sentence against an evil work is not executed speedily, therefore the heart of the sons of men is fully set in them to do evil. You know, again, it's crazy to see our judicial system, our justice system, take a person that is clearly guilty and allow him trial after trial, appeal after appeal, only to have him sit in a jail or a prison at the taxpayer's expense, sometimes living better than the rest of society. It's sad to see what goes on. They're not being judged. They're being pampered. And you look at these places where crime is dealt with speedily and harshly, and you'll notice that oftentimes that crime is not as prevalent. Man, you go to some societies where a person that's a thief, you know, going to have their hand chopped off. They're going to deal with it speedily, and oftentimes you see the crime rate dropping. And we seem to prolong things and drag things out so often. And it just begins to pollute and defile the land, just as the word of God is showing here. Therefore, in verse 34, do not defile the land which you inhabit, in the midst of which I dwell, for I, the Lord, dwell among the children of Israel. Do not defile the land. When a nation walks down the path of depravity, the land itself will suffer along with the people. Now, chapter 36, real quickly, because this is kind of, again, goes through an incident that we've already seen in Numbers chapter 27, but adds in a few more details for us. And it's referring to the daughters of Zelophehad, who came with kind of this first, you know, women's movement in the Bible. They came saying, listen, in Numbers 27, if our father dies, doesn't have any sons or any, you know, other relatives around, when he dies, who's going to receive his portion of land, his inheritance? Shall it not fall upon us? Why should we just kind of let it pass away as though, you know, in his name to sort of be forgotten? And so Moses sought the Lord, and God said, okay, then the land shall go to the daughters. But now look at chapter 36, and we see a few more details being added to it. Now the chief fathers of the families of the children of Gilead, the son of Machir, the son of Manasseh, of the families of the sons of Joseph, came near and spoke before Moses and before the leaders, the chief fathers of the children of Israel. And they said, the Lord commanded my Lord Moses to give the land as an inheritance by lot to the children of Israel. And my Lord was commanded by the Lord to give the inheritance of our brother Zelophehad to his daughters. Now, if they are married to any of the sons of the other tribes of the children of Israel, then their inheritance will be taken from the inheritance of our fathers, and it will be added to the inheritance of the tribe into which they marry. So it will be taken from the lot of our inheritance. So the concern came up that if they marry outside their tribe, that tribe would lose a portion of their land. And so this is the concern that they have. So verse 4, and when the jubilee of the children of Israel comes, then their inheritance will be added to the inheritance of the tribe into which they marry. So their inheritance will be taken away from the inheritance of the tribe of our fathers. Then Moses commanded the children of Israel according to the word of the Lord, saying, what the tribe of the sons of Joseph speaks is right. This is what the Lord commands concerning the daughters of Zelophehad, saying, let them marry whom they think best, but here's the deal, they may marry only within the family of their father's tribe. So God instructs that they should only marry within their tribe. That way land would not become depleted within a tribe. It would not be passed on to the tribe that they would marry into. So they must marry only within their own tribe. That way the land will stay within that tribe. So, verse 7, the inheritance of the children of Israel shall not change hands from tribe to tribe. For every one of the children of Israel shall keep the inheritance of the tribe of his fathers. And every daughter who possesses an inheritance in any tribe of the children of Israel shall be the wife of one of the family of her father's tribe, so that the children of Israel each may possess the inheritance of his fathers. Thus, no inheritance shall change hands from one tribe to another, but every tribe of the children of Israel shall keep its own inheritance. Just as the Lord commanded Moses, so did the daughters of Zelophehad. For Mahlah, Tirzah, Hoglah, Milcah, and Noah. Those were the names of the daughters. Great names if you're, again, if you need some baby names, there you go. The daughters of Zelophehad were married to the sons of their father's brothers. They were married into the families of the children of Manasseh, the son of Joseph, and their inheritance remained in the tribe of their father's family. These are the commandments and the judgments which the Lord commanded the children of Israel by the hand of Moses in the plains of Moab by the Jordan across from Jericho. So here it ends now, the book of Numbers. Here are the commandments and the judgments which the Lord commanded. The instructions are given. The nation of Israel is equipped. They're ready. And now God is saying it's time to move into the land. You are to be charged up, ready to roll. And Deuteronomy is going to go through and kind of recap those things that we have seen throughout the book of Leviticus and Numbers again and all through their journeys. And again, the different commands that God gave. Deuteronomy is a great book too that is, I think, the most quoted Old Testament book by Jesus and throughout the New Testament. So a lot of quotations come from the book of Deuteronomy in the New Testament. It's a great book. But in ending this chapter here, this account now of Zelophehad's daughters ties in with what Paul addressed in 2 Corinthians 6, where he says, do not be unequally yoked. You see, when we begin to mix with people that are not of God, we are going to be losing ground. And again, it ties in with, you know, the tribe of Levi and how they were to be scattered throughout the land and they were to influence. But as they do here, the Zelophehad's daughters are not to go and marry with another tribe. Otherwise, they will be giving something up. They will be losing ground. And parents, I say this to you that have young kids. Raise your kids up in this principle and let them know it's not just nice if it works out that way when they get older and they marry another Christian. You let them know it's an absolute necessity. This is not a negotiable thing. Find someone who has the same desire and devotion for God as you and link up with those who are linked to God. Otherwise, you will be those that lose a part of what God has for you. He has nothing but your best interest at heart. He's not doing it to make things difficult. He's not doing it to say, well, you know, I don't want you to have all that fun that those people are having. I want you to marry somebody that's like-minded as I am. God's saying, I have your best interest at heart. And it's sad to see Christians that get entangled into relationships with other, with non-believers, and who get this concept, that this mindset that, oh, I think he's very close. I think I can win him over for the Lord. And you've heard the expression missionary dating. A lot of people like to try that, you know. I'm going to date this person and we're going to save them for the Lord. What happens oftentimes is that the person that's trying to win the person for the Lord is the one, again, that's influenced by the other person. And soon they find themselves not going to church as much, not spending time reading the Word as much and praying as much, because they don't see it in their partner, or however you want to describe that, their boyfriend or their girlfriend. Don't fall into that trap, guys. You find people that have the same passion for the Lord as you do, if you're not married and you're hoping to be soon. Find people that have the same passion for the Lord, or else you will be the ones that's giving up ground. Don't let that happen. Let's pray.